Marty Moscawain. When a person receives a grave or terminal diagnosis, it has a ripple effect on families. The specter of death looms, but nobody knows how long the loved one will be among them. It's a time of many raging emotions, a time of tough decisions, medical treatments, and often exhausting responsibilities, not just for the ill person, but their whole family. It's also a time when unresolved family issues can come to the surface, old arguments start up, old wounds are opened, or it can be a time of closeness, gratitude, and renewal. Our guest today has written a guide to help families cope with such difficult times. Dr. Barbara Okin is counseling psychology professor at Northwestern University. She's also a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School. Her new book is Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss. She co-authored this book with Joseph Nowinski, and she's joining us from the Science Monitor Studios in Boston. Dr. Okin, thank you so much for being on Radio Times.
Thank you for asking me, and let me just correct, I'm at Northeastern University, although my doctorate is from Northwestern University.
Oh, I have it right in my notes. I just misread it, so I apologize.
That's okay.
For that. So what is the new grief you talk about in your book?
Well, the new grief is more of a process rather than an event, because it can last for many, many years even. I mean, several decades ago, if you got a diagnosis of a potentially fatal illness, you were lucky if you had weeks, much less a couple of months, to deal with it. And today, with modern medical technology, survivors, cancer survivors, may live for many, many years. So it's a process where from the moment of diagnosis, things change, and the family is part of the process, and so is the patient. The patient is part of deciding how he or she wants to live the rest of their life, and there's plenty of time for planning and preparation, and as you said beautifully, healing old wounds.
We are talking with Dr. Barbara Okin, who's written a new book for grieving families and families going through a hard time with illness. If you want to join the conversation, our number here is 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. Now, could you describe your own experience with your husband, which you talk about in your book?
Well, my husband had been diagnosed with prostate cancer, which was treatable and was not an issue, about 6 or 7 years before he was diagnosed with a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And because of my professional experience and my contact with oncologists, I sort of knew what the timeline might be, and it turned out to be pretty accurate. And we talked about it openly from the beginning. Our whole family participated, and we had our ups and downs, no questions about it. We did all the things we always wanted to do. We took a trip to India and Bhutan after he finished his first round of chemo, and unfortunately that was the last trip we took. But we tried to make the best of it. I think what I learned from that, or one of the things that influenced me to writing this book, was I let go. I didn't pursue some of the pragmatics that I should have, which made the ending very, very difficult.
And I want to get to that in a moment, though. I wanted to ask you, did you, the experience of your husband having cancer previously, was that in any way helpful, because you had, as a family, been through a tough time once before? Did you learn any lessons from that illness that helped you with the second one?
No, except I guess I wasn't as surprised when the second one came around. I've worked with many families and patients with cancer, so it's something I've been familiar with. It's an interesting question. I think I almost thought, aha. So now it's our turn.
Hmm. How did your husband deal? Let's start with him. Once he received the diagnosis, you describe different stages of grief in your book, and I guess one stage is the crisis.
Well, actually, he wasn't here when the diagnosis came through. He had had a couple of lumps, and he had a biopsy, but he and a buddy had planned a fishing trip to some place in Mexico that was totally unconnected. So I was the one who got all the test results and had notified family and close friends, so that by the time he came back from this trip, he had a very strong supportive network. And he was very strong and very courageous throughout. I mean, he tried everything, and he continued his full functioning, really, until very close to the end.
Now, what you just said brings up the issue of notifying, and you discuss this in your book. So did you feel that it was okay to notify people before he even knew? Because a lot of times that very issue gets people off either on the right or the
Absolutely.
Wrong path.
In our case, I needed the help of some of our physician friends. And I also, because I went through a difficult week because I suspected what the answer was going to be, I needed the support of my adult children. And my husband was very happy when he came back that he had such a loving support group right there. But in some cases, that's an issue we work with families, who to tell and who not to tell. I cite one case in my book of a man who was diagnosed with colon cancer. He was in his 50s at the time. He had a very successful consulting business, and he told everybody that he was going to be taking 6 months off for treatment, and everybody wrote him off. By the time he finished his treatment and was fine, he had to start from anew. All his previous clients had gone someplace else. And when I interviewed him, he said to me he would advise people not to tell. Then there's the issue of who do you tell in your family? And so much depends on how you've been functioning as a family in the past. Are you an open system family or towards that continuum where there's open communication among adult members? Or are you more closed system where people don't share their feelings and their thoughts? So the family's history, how they've dealt with crises in the past and their attitudes towards it really would depend on who they tell and how they tell.
That's Dr. Barbara Okun. She's written a new book called Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss. And she co-authored this book with Joseph Nowinski. And she's joining us from Boston, where she's at the Science Monitor Studios, Christian Science Monitor Studios. And you give advice in your book at the moment of the diagnosis to kind of take a moment and to think about how you're going to communicate what's happening to you.
Well, I should say that not everybody gets a diagnosis so quickly. There are many people who wait weeks, even months, for the final diagnosis. And this is a very stressful period because you're going for these tests, then you have to wait for the results, then more tests or another consultation. And when you get the diagnosis, sometimes it's a relief. At least you know what the problem is. And I think that that's a time when everybody sort of has to get together and be very pragmatic about what you're going to do. Do you want to get a consultation from a different physician, a different medical system? And some people don't know what questions to ask and how to do this. So that's the first order of business for the patient and the family to attend to. And in today's era of the medical system, it's really important that somebody in the family be available to advocate for the patient. And somebody, for example, be available to advocate with the insurance company. So there are a lot of tasks that preoccupy people during this time of diagnosis. So that maybe those tasks help people through the shock and the emotional pain that's associated with thinking about your vulnerability and your mortality.
And you also describe in your book that not disclosing what's happening with you often causes a lot of hurt. For example, when parents are trying to protect their children from the fact that they are very ill, and then the children find out and are really hurt.
Well, aside from that, children sense when there's a problem. So
yeah.
You're not protecting your children, you're protecting yourself. And we know now that children already know about death and dying. They've seen death and dying in their peers, friends, in their pets, on television, in the movies. So we recommend very strongly that people speak at an appropriately developmental level to children and tell them when somebody is sick and what it means to them, what it's going to mean to them.
Now, you described earlier on that you brought your family in and around you, and you had grown children and grandchildren, but everybody kind of circled around you as your husband was dealing with this.
Absolutely. And I have two children who live in the area and one who lives across the country. But today, fortunately, we were able to stay close in touch. But this is another thing that families have to remember. Families are very different today than they used to be. Women are often working, so daughters and daughters-in-law and mothers can't always be around all the time to provide primary care. Families don't always live in the same geographical area. And families are more complex today. There's more divorce, blended families, interfaith, interracial families, gay and lesbian families, single parents by choice. So I'm saying, with the complexity of today's contemporary families and complex roles, particularly in today's economy, people can't take time off from work or assume that the job will be held, or that if they leave work to take care of somebody, they'll find another job. We have to take all of that into consideration when we have expectations and when the family decides how they're going to cope with this problem over the long term.
And we have about a minute before we go to a break, but you said earlier that there were some things that you put off and then regretted. They were more kind of pragmatic issues. What were they?
Well, I had asked my husband when he first was diagnosed, I said, you know, it would be very helpful to me if you would write a manual with all your accounts, passwords, just so I know all the things that he took care of. And he never wanted to do that. Now I advocate very strongly that people always prepare a just-in-case at all ages, just so that that would take the stress off family members not knowing what people would have wanted and where documents, important documents, are.
And so you had a hard time gathering all that after your husband's death then?
I did. And I didn't know what questions to ask or what papers to look for. So it was confusing.
And do you have that kind of information prepared now?
Yes, I certainly do, and I think everybody who knows me does. I get after them. Young couples, too. It's just like when a newborn is born. It's really important and responsible for the parents to legally designate who would be guardian, just in case. Well, I think we all have to take responsibility for leaving that information, like if we're traveling, or no matter what, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody, when, or how.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking with Dr. Barbara Okin. She has written a new book, Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss. It's co-authored with Joseph Nowinski and talks about the new grief of maybe experiencing a prolonged illness and therefore prolonged grief. We'll talk more after our break. Give us a call if you want to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
How does where you are influence what you do? The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents Here, an exhibition that looks at how the work of contemporary artists is saturated with the experience of where they live. On view now through December 31st. Here showcases the work of 24 artists and artist collectives from 6 different regions of the country. For details, 215-972-7600 or PAFA.org.
Picky eaters, hectic schedules, rising grocery prices. Many families struggle to make meals that fit their budgets, tastes, and lives, and are healthy to boot. I'm Mike and Scott. Join us for the next WHYY Parenting Seminar, when we'll discuss healthy nutrition for kids and families. We'll also talk about cooking with children. Tuesday, November 8th at 6:30 here at WHYY. To register, visit whyy.org/member experience.
Friends Select School, the Center City Quaker School, supports WHYY. Located on Benjamin Franklin Parkway, Philadelphia's Cultural Boulevard, Friends Select invites students in grades pre-K through 12 to experience a challenging academic program coupled with the cultural resources the city has to offer. Their next open house is Friday, November 11th. Details at friends-select.org. Friends Select School, the Center City Quaker School.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about something called the new grief, when families go through prolonged periods of grief when a loved one has a terminal or grave illness they are dealing with. And our guest is Dr. Barbara Okun. She is a counseling psychology professor at Northeastern University, and her new book is Saying Goodbye: How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss. And Dr. Okun, before our break, we were talking about your own experience with your husband passing away from cancer. And your family, it seemed to me reading your book that your family was very close before this happened and remained very close.
Yes, I think I would like to think that, yes, they came through. They were wonderful, even the grandchildren. I mean, I can remember the last couple of days of my husband's life. The twins, who were 3 and a half at the time, were out. This was in the summer. Were out playing, and they would pick wildflowers and come in and kiss his hand and climb on the bed and kiss him. I mean, they were part of the process. And it helped the adults in the family, who were all congregated there, to have young children around. It really put a different dimension on it by including children in the process of saying goodbye.
Now, how has this process, you said earlier on in the program how, you know, obviously a lot of times in many situations, the person we're grieving in a way is there with us along the way, and they are also grieving the loss of their own health, the loss of their lives as they go through this process. How does that change everything?
Well, it depends whether they're willing to talk about it. Some people are and some people aren't. And it depends on what the roles and functions and relationships have been with different people. I think that one of the questions that I ask people in this situation is, what is it you would like to have done? What do you want to have done by the time it's time to say goodbye? How would you like things to be different? Now's the time. And also, this period of time, which goes through five of the phases that we talk about in the book, allows plenty of time for people to act on their bucket list. Take the trips. Do the things you've never done. Have the conversations you haven't had. Decide what you want to do with your precious valuables. Talk about what you would want for your family, how you would want them to go on after you're not there. Bring it out and talk. Conversation and relationships are the most important part of living, much less dying. And just as people today can choose how they want to be born, not how they want to be born, parents can choose how they want to give birth in a hospital with a midwife, in a bathtub, sitting up, squatting, lying down. People also have the opportunity to think about how they want to die. Where do they want to die? Who do they want to be with them?
But
what do they want?
I'm wondering, though, if sometimes when it's not clear, is this a terminal diagnosis or maybe I can recover, does it sometimes feel, well, if we're talking about death, then we're giving up? And I hear that sometimes from families. And from people, they say, well, I don't want to talk about me dying because I'm not going to die now.
No, I hear what you're saying, and I think that's true. And there's a balance between optimistic, you know, optimism, hopefulness, and realism. What if? And that's why I talk about the book, the pamphlet, the manual, as the just-in-case manual. Just in case. I suggest people start thinking about that before they have treatments that might affect how they think and feel. Because when you're strong and when you're first feeling about it, just in case, this is what I would want to have happen. Now let's move on. It's a relief if you're able to have talked about it. I don't mean belaboring and talking about death and dying every time you're with somebody. Not at all. Once you've had the conversations, it's a relief, and people have an energy with which they can go on with their life.
And we have Pat joining us from Paulsboro, New Jersey. Hi, Pat. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My husband died 2 years ago, November 22nd. And he had Crohn's disease, and plus he picked up an infection in the hospital. And my question had to do with the funeral itself, because there's really no resource to tell you how to throw a funeral. It's not like a wedding where you know every step of the way. And I was by myself. I had no clue. on what to do at the funeral. I had a good funeral. He was well loved in the community, but like I didn't know where to go, where to stand at the funeral. You know what to do. It was really hard, and it was a little embarrassing because everybody was waiting for me to do something. And also, you mentioned anger. I was extremely angry for like 6 months or a year before he died, as well as after he died. And I took it out on anybody close, you know.
What was your anger described? Obviously,
I just didn't believe he would die. I thought he would, though. I wanted him to get a transplant, but he never got healthy enough for it.
Yeah.
He was actually okayed for it.
You know, the anger.
So when he called
felt
hospice, I was just totally shocked.
Yeah, yeah. Pat, thank you so much for your call. Hold on. We're going to just have Dr. Okun weigh in on your first question about the funeral.
Well, usually clergy or social workers or funeral homes tell you what your options are. I'm so sorry you had that experience. And I wanted to respond to you by saying also that the anger that you've experienced, the shock that this could happen to you, is so normal. And it has a positive side in terms of giving you energy to get through. It's sort of a protective coat of rage that allows you to do what you have to do. You're a remarkably brave woman.
And Barbara Okun, I want to talk a little bit more about the five stages you describe in your book of grieving. Can you talk a bit about that? We've hit on crisis, which is the first part when you get the diagnosis.
Yeah, crisis is when the family is really disrupted by the diagnosis. Everybody's upset, saddened, and anxious. And then there are other unexpected feelings of resentment, anger, or guilt. But they usually go unexpressed because everybody wants to rally around the patient. And as I said earlier, there's so many tasks, like, are you sure this is the doctor you want to see? You'd be surprised, by the way, how many people don't go to specialists. They'll hear their primary care physician give them a diagnosis or a urologist tell them they need to have surgery without seeing an oncologist. So there's a lot of education that has to take place during this time. The next phase is unity, and that's when, of course, the patient's needs are paramount, but this is when everybody's on the same page. What can we all do to help? And activities, you know, include managing the medical treatment, lining up social and support services, getting information. And this is the time when I recommend starting the Just In Case manual. Be sure that your will is up to date, healthcare proxy, advanced care directives, all of those important, important papers. And then as time goes on, the next phase may be upheaval. And that's when the patient may be in remission or actually doing relatively well. But for others, the unity in patients begins to wear thin as protracted illnesses buffets their lives, relationships, and routines. How many times can you go visit? How many times can you do this? It's like your adrenaline can't stay charged continuously. And so at this time, some of the repressed hostilities and resentments and unfinished business crop up. And the best way to deal with that is by talking about it, but also by sharing the burdens of caretaking and everybody taking care of themselves, not just the patient. And this is where palliative care comes in terms of how do people take care of themselves so that they can be helpful to others.
And you describe, I want to get to more of the stages in just a second, but for example, you give a good example in your book of two sisters who are caring for the father, and the one sister doesn't find out till after the father passed away that the other sister felt very alone through the process because she, the sister, lives further away and can't be there all the time. So oftentimes families don't talk about their frustrations.
No, they don't. I talk about one family where the oldest child was a nurse, a daughter, And she did live close, and she automatically took on the role of caretaker, which she had her entire life in this family. And it was getting to the point where in this stage, the upheaval stage, a couple of years had passed, and she was still leaving her family with young children to go take care of her parents all the time. And her husband was getting a little frustrated, and she was wearing herself thin. And finally, her doctor said, "You can't go every weekend. You've got to get somebody else to go." And she called her brother, who lived a couple of hours away, and asked him if he could go. And he said, "I would love to. I just never thought you would ask, or that you, I thought you wanted to do it all yourself." So you see, this is what I mean when communications aren't clear and people get the wrong messages.
And now let's move on to the next phase, which you just hit upon, which is resolution. So sometimes these things do get resolved.
Well, resolution is really occurs when the remission sort of ends and the patient's health deteriorates and everybody comes to accept that the end is near. And hopefully decisions about end-of-life matters have been made, but they may need to be revisited if things have happened or changed over the years since they were first made. So this is the opportunity for resolving old issues, healing wounds, and resentments and jealousies, and thinking about how we're going to stay as a family after this person leaves. And it's a joint process, and everybody gets a chance to say their goodbyes. And I liken it to thinking about not having any regrets. And it's a gift, by the way, for many patients, at least that's what our interviewees have told us, to have this opportunity to finish unfinished business. But it's also a tremendous gift for survivors.
That's Dr. Barbara Okun. She has a new book called Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss. She's our guest today on Radio Times. And we have another call at 1-888-477-9499. We have Sharon joining us from Bethlehem. Hi, Sharon. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hello. My family can't figure out the holidays. We lost a 6-year-old boy to neuroblastoma after a 4-year battle. This happened 9 months ago, and my daughter, he was my grandson. My daughter and son-in-law are extremely high-functioning people, very successful, but this holiday period has us absolutely stumped. And the only thing we can figure out, we need to get away from Thanksgiving, but we're probably going to split up. I'm going to go to Germany. They're thinking of going to Trinidad. We just have to get away from all this family happiness. Are there any other options?
And you lost him this year?
In January, this past January.
I'm so sorry,
my heart,
Sharon,
goes out to you. Yes. You know, it's an interesting question you raise. And what a lot of families do is what you're thinking of doing. They want to change the way they do the holidays. And so some travel. They find alternatives. And each family has to find their own way. The most important thing is to keep the family spirit together.
Well, we're thinking of splitting up. My daughter and son-in-law are obviously more affected by it than I was, particularly my daughter, who spent 4 years living at Sloan Kettering.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I was 75 miles away up in Bethlehem, so I'm not quite as affected by it. That's why I say I'm thinking of going to Germany, but we're splitting up. I can't even see her grief.
I understand that, and there's no one right or way or wrong way. People have to do what they have to do. The main thing is to communicate love and support, but that doesn't mean you have to sit around a holiday dinner together. You need to do what feels like it would be the best thing for you to do. You have to give yourself permission. If splitting up is what you want to do, what feels right, because different people have different needs, and let's respect that.
And Dr. Okun, what can people do to fill the void after you've spent so many years caring for somebody when that person is no longer there? We're not just talking about the terrible loss of that person, but also suddenly your role is gone and your schedule is clear. So how do you deal with that?
Well, you have to you change your identity. You would develop your identity, but you have to give yourself time, because physically and emotionally you need time to maybe do nothing, just to be for a while. However, if we're talking about an adult person who's died, there are a lot of tasks that will keep you busy for the first year, not just legal tasks, but in terms of a person's possessions, perhaps having to change residency. There are a lot of tasks that distract you. And then you really need to begin to take some steps to think about how you can find new meaning in your life, a new job, so to speak. And I often suggest to people that they start off with some volunteer activities, trying something new that they haven't done before, and give themselves time. That's probably one of the best gifts. Give yourself time for healing. Take good care of yourself.
And can you remember from the time when your husband passed away, what were some things that were helpful to you during that time? What did you do during the holidays, and how did you deal?
Well, my husband died in summer, and I was also working full-time, so I had something that was important for me. But he died in the summer, and we spent our summers on Martha's Vineyard, and we have a strong community of friends and family there, so that I felt very cushioned and protected and loved that summer. We decided to have Thanksgiving together. That was very important for us, and we did that. One of the things that I think is really important when you celebrate the holidays, and I should say that I was married on Thanksgiving Day, so that my anniversary periodically is on that day or the day before or the day after, but to talk about the person who's missing and not to not talk about them, because they're always there and part of you. And that's really harder when it's a child, but it's still important to talk about it. And to understand that you will always have that person with you, and so does your family. But I think we have to be open to new ways of experiencing holidays.
Do you, going back to Sharon's situation, do you think sometimes, especially communities, have harder times talking about it when it is a child because they simply don't know what to say?
I think that's true when it's anybody. Nobody knows what to say, really. And many times people say mean well and say things that can be quite hurtful.
We're talking... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but not talking about the person, acting as if they never lived, I think is very painful.
So trying to find a way to say something is better than not saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Dr. Barbara Okun. She is a counseling psychology professor at Northeastern University. She's also a clinical instructor at Harvard Medical School, and she has written a new book, which is called Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss, which she co-authored with Joseph Nowinski. And she's joining us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Boston. We'll talk more after our break. Give us a call if you have a question for Dr. Okun at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499, and we'll get to the last stage that you describe in your book of grief, which is renewal. So stay tuned for that here on Radio Times on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Jewish Studies Department at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey, now offering an interdisciplinary master's degree in Jewish Studies. Merit-based fellowships, full and part-time options available. Details at jewishstudies.rutgers.edu.
In 14 years on Saturday Night Live, Daryl Hammond did many impressions, including Bill Clinton.
I rehearsed it with a southern accent, and then I put in this little crackle in my voice.
Few of the cast members knew Hammond struggled with drink, drugs, and self-cutting as a result of childhood abuse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Daryl Hammond. He has a new memoir.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The suicide rate has been increasing in the last decade here in the U.S. Suicide is among the 10 leading causes of death.
I felt like I was in this box, nobody around, I couldn't get out, and nobody could get in.
I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll explore this difficult and painful topic. We'll hear about the void left behind in families affected by suicide and discuss prevention. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Cayley Group, presenting Irish musicians Mick Maloney and Friends in concert, Saturday, November 12th, 8 p.m. at the Commodore Barry Club. Tickets at philadelphiacaleygroup.com.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Dr. Barbara Okin, who has written a new book called Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss. And renewal, Dr. Okin, is what I wanted to talk about next to, because that is one of the stages of grief that you describe in the book.
Yes, I wanted to go back for just a minute to resolution, because during that phase, families often together plan the funeral or memorial service, and with the patient being very much part of the process, who they want to be pallbearers, who they want to officiate, do they want to be buried, cremated, where, what kind of music do they want, and who they want to give a eulogy, and sometimes they write something that they want read, or they pick certain psalms or poems.
I recently went to a funeral that had been entirely orchestrated, up to the catering and the flowers, by the person we were remembering that day. Yeah, so that is becoming more common. But I would think it takes a certain kind of person who is able to do that.
By that stage, though, that's at that. By the stage of resolution, the person knows the time is limited. And so more people are ready to do that. It's the family sometimes that are not. So the families need to do some work to remember that it's the comfort and dignity of the patient that's paramount. The reason I wanted to bring that up is how the resolution stage is experienced by family members depends a great deal on how the previous stages were experienced. The renewal stage is the final stage that begins with the funeral, and it continues for a long time as individuals adjust to the loss and to their changed roles, and as the family system becomes reorganized. In prolonged death, as opposed to sudden death, with somebody dying in an accident or from a heart attack or something immediately, there has been a chance for the family to talk and to process the value of their relationships. And the research shows that the renewal stage and the grieving stage is not easier. Grieving is never easier. But it seems to feel better when you've had that opportunity, so that you're not stuck with bitter regrets and feeling like you could have done this. There's no self-blame. And I think that families have to understand that different members of the family grieve differently. It takes different kinds of time, that we have to be kind and respectful and supportive, but understand that people have different needs. And this is where, at this time of the year, as the caller in noted earlier, planning for holidays. You know, we do have to celebrate the holidays if there are children involved in particular, but it can be done differently. But how are we going to stay connected, particularly if the person who died was the one who kept the family connected? How are we going to pass on? Who's going to take on those roles and functions? And how can we be connected in a way that would have pleased the person who's not there anymore? So it's a long process.
Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Pierre joining us from Reading. Hi, Pierre. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments. First, for the woman who called in about not knowing what to do, about planning a funeral and what to do. You know, funerals are really hard. With a wedding, you've got a year to plan. With a funeral, you've got 4 days, and it's got to be just as good. And so in the funerals that I had to deal with in my life, we found that just accessing information from people who had to go through it before, what do you do it, how do you set it up, but also that my mother, before she died, had completely planned her funeral, I mean, down to the scriptures that she wanted read and what we should do. So that made it a lot easier. So that's one thing. The other thing is the woman on what to do with the holidays. In 2000, my mother passed away in June after a long bout with lung cancer, and then 2 months later, my eldest sister dropped dead. And so we were devastated, just reeling from one after the other. And, of course, you know, Christmas followed. So what we all did is my whole family that was left, we went away. We just took 5 days at Christmas, went to Williamsburg, had a really wonderful time. It was just a totally different environment that took us out of memories that could have been painful at the time, but allowed us to still celebrate and cherish and remember and grieve. And that really helped us out as a family. So, you know, for anyone who's listening to this, I just hope that they realize that it's important to keep the spirit of holidays alive with people that you loved who are no longer with you. And as the good doctor said, is to remember and have joy in the times that you spent, even though you may have to reinvent the things that you do to observe holidays that were meaningful and important to everybody.
Thank you so much, Pierre.
Beautiful. I love everything you've said. You put it just beautifully. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So we will go right to our next call. We have Renee joining us from Millersville. Hi, Renee. You're on Radio Times. Hold on 1 second. Renee, are you there with us?
I am.
Okay. What can we do for you?
My husband died not quite a year ago. I'm coming up on the first anniversary of his death. I'd like the doctor to maybe talk about things that those of us in this situation can do as we approach that anniversary. I'm finding it a very difficult time. He died after a 16-month bout with cancer, very horrific. I'm, of course, devastated. We were married 41 years. And I've had wonderful support through church and family, but, it's still very difficult.
It is difficult, and there are always going to be those milestone events. I think you have to do what feels right to you. I know I always go to religious services and visit my husband's grave. I talk to my children on these anniversary dates. But basically, he died in the summer, so I get to do my favorite thing that the two of us used to do, which is walk on the beach. But I think that it's important to allow yourself to grieve, to feel the pain. And if you want to be with people, fine. But if you don't, fine. There isn't a recipe or a menu. But just cherish the fact that you have these feelings and these memories.
And Dr. Okun, is sometimes the time leading toward the anniversary just as painful because you have that building anxiety of how am I going to handle it even weeks before the day actually comes?
Absolutely. And most of my patients tell me that. And we talk a lot about it because that's when they want to talk about the person they've lost. And sometimes they don't feel they can with their families. I will tell you one thing that people have said and that I've experienced too. If your family members just give you a call or drop you a note on that day, that means so much to know that other people are remembering and it's just not you.
Let's take another call. We have Michael joining us from Newark. Hi, Michael. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Mike. And my son killed Thanksgiving Day last year, and my wife and I have been struggling with how to deal with it. There's so much going on. Our anniversary, my granddaughter's birthday. So we decided, and Thanksgiving was one of his favorite times of the year. We're going to make it big, and we have a large family, so we're going to have a big Thanksgiving dinner. And then the day after, his friends are going to join us, and it's all going to be about celebrating his life. But it's obviously a very painful time, but we don't want to run from it. We want to try to make it something special as much as we can.
Oh, that's wonderful. I wish you the best. God bless. I mean, that's just, you're doing both things. You're maintaining your holiday with your family because it was his favorite holiday as well as yours, and you're including his friends in a memorial. Very, very special. I wish you well.
Thank you so much, Michael, for calling in. And I will say that I've met Michael. I know who you are. I did a report on you, and I wish you the best. And I think of you often. But Dr. Okun, I wanted to ask you, you write a lot of beautiful stories in your book about how families come together during these hard times. For example, you describe a couple, they are farmers, and they have long struggled with their oldest son because he doesn't want to be involved with the farm, and then he does. And during the time when the father gets sick, they actually pull together and solve family issues. So talk a bit about how that can happen.
Well, it's an opportunity, and you know, every event can be a catastrophe slash crisis, but it can also be a challenge and an opportunity. And I think that families have a lot of strength. I think most families have a lot of bonds of love. And the issue for families is to focus on the strengths, not on the weaknesses. I guess there's another part of it, and that is respecting the differences and also trying to give people space to grow on their own, which is what that couple did with their son, and come up with creative alternatives to whatever the problem may be.
And what are some things that, you know, sometimes I wonder if we are getting better as a society in talking about death. And what's your take on that? Because, you know, topics like this are very hard, and you said earlier, you know, all of us should have a will prepared when we have small children, you know, at any times in our lives, but so many of us don't, and we know that we should, but there's a certain reluctance to tackle this topic.
Well, that's true. I remember a man that I was working with who knew he was terminally ill. He did not have children. He was married. He refused to make a will because in his mind that meant that he was going to die if he had a will. And it was only when we were able to tell him that if he died without a will, his brother and sister, as the only blood heirs, would get half and his wife only half of his estate. And he was estranged from his brother and sister, and that motivated him to make a will. So sometimes we have to sort of, you know, find ways to convince people that, yes, you're helping. It's a loving, responsible gesture to help people and to do the best you can so that they can deal with it. Talking about death and dying is easier than it was, but it's still a major cultural taboo. So, I have many people who just can't do it.
So what happens when, you know, when you're at a party and people say, so what do you do for a living? And then you talk about your new book.
You know what happens? I want to write a new book because everybody has a story. Every place I go, I hear the most incredible stories. I think, gee, I wish I'd heard that. I could have used it in the book. But it helps. It's positive. People do talk about it more and more. They say, I didn't know that. And I've had more people come up to me and say, I wish I'd read your book before my husband died or before my wife died. I'm giving it to my children. I want them to have it.
But we typically talk after we've already suffered through something rather than in preparation.
Well, programs like yours and other articles in the media, I think, are opening up the subject more and more. And also now I work in a hospital and I know that the medical profession, all of them, are being trained to bring up these topics too, which they never did before. They would wait for the patient because it's unpleasant for doctors. But if part of their curriculum is to deal with end-of-life issues and choices and options, that will make it easier for the patients and their families.
So going forward, what are some things that you really want to make sure people talk about? What interests you around this topic?
Well, what I want people to talk about is thinking about what they would want and trying to stay connected with people and, you know, finding ways to be with your family in meaningful ways and activities. Just thinking about what you have rather than what you don't have and taking each day to live as fully as possible. And this is not just for the person with the disease. This is for everybody. It's just a slight different awareness. It's the awareness of uncertainty, which we all have, but we bury it.
And do you feel, you said your husband died more quickly maybe than you had expected, but do you feel that you really took advantage of the time you had?
Yes, we traveled. Yes, we did. But the thing that I was the most happy about is he actually didn't die of cancer. He died of side effects of the treatment. And he had been medevaced from Martha's Vineyard to a major hospital in Boston, and they knew he wanted to die on the vineyard in his own bed by his own ocean, and they saw to it that he was able to do that. And so he had what I would call a good death, surrounded by family and friends, everybody had a chance to say goodbye in his own bed. They tried to get him into a hospital bed. He refused. And, of course, I didn't want him in a hospital bed because I wanted to be able to be with him. So I think he died at peace and feeling that he gave us a gift.
And maybe in closing, we haven't talked much about when families have very difficult family situations, whether it's fragmented families with divorces and so on. But what's your advice when you just have to bring a whole big group of people together who may not get along very well?
Well, that's when it's usually a good idea to get a clergy person or a professional counselor in to help them. To help them talk about it and see if they can resolve what some of the differences are. That requires cooperation. There may be some members of the family that are able to do that and some who aren't. And that's also true with the person who's dying. I've known people who've tried to make peace with their dying parent. But if the dying parent isn't willing to do it, there's nothing that can be a positive outcome. But at least you know you've tried.
And when you said earlier so many people are telling you stories, are people also telling you those positive stories of
coming
yes. together?
Yes. Yes, yes. People are telling me that they've had reconciliations from family members they've been estranged from for decades.
That's Dr. Barbara Okin, and with that we have to close. Thank you so much for joining us today. Her new book is Saying Goodbye, How Families Can Find Renewal Through Loss, which she co-authored with Joseph Nowinski. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Bilder. Our engineer has been Kevin Griffin, and we also had help from Al Banks. This is Radio Times, and you're listening to WHYY.